Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Author Joyce Carol Oates returns with a new novel, The Sacrifice, which illuminates the tragic impact of sexual violence, racism, brutality, and power on innocent lives, and probes the persistence of stereotypes, the nature of revenge, the complexities of truth, and our insatiable hunger for sensationalism. Joyce Carol Oates is a recipient of the National Medal of Humanities, the National Book Award, and the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in Short Fiction. She's been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. Her classic novels include We Were the Mulvaneys, Blonde, and the New York Times bestseller The Accursed. She is the Roger Berlin Distinguished Professor of the Humanities at Princeton University, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Joyce Carol Oates to the Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight.
Thank you.
What brought you to this subject of looking at what seems to be very much based on the Tawana Brawley case?
Well, I had always wanted to do another novel about urban civic unrest, as it's called, since I had written the novel called Them quite a long time ago, having lived in Detroit during the time of the Detroit riot, which was in July 1967. It was quite an extraordinary experience to live through. And basically, I had been quite mesmerized by the subject. I wrote Them, which is from the point of view of a white family, because basically that's all I knew at the time. But then in subsequent years, I always wanted to go back to the subject of writing about a family in a large American city in which there is racial tension. There isn't any racial violence in a public sense in my novel, The Sacrifice, but there has been in this sort of a spillover from the Newark riot in 1967, and they're still talking about it in 1988. So basically, I wanted to revisit that world, but now I know much more. Now I read much more because more has been written on the subject. And the Tawana Brawley case is 1988 or 1987, and then the special grand jury report, which I read, and I mentioned it in my bibliography at the end of the novel, that came out in October 1988. So all those years, you know, the situation in our urban cities has basically been deteriorating, I think. And I wanted to write about an episode that seems to exemplify these problems, but I wanted to write about it from the point of view of people. I'm basically not writing a criminology book or a sociological book. It's about a family. It's a black family, and there's a daughter, a mother, and a stepfather. Then there are other characters who are related to them. And I wanted to tell the story in different people's voices from the perspective of a number of witnesses who are making comments and observing. There's one chapter set in the emergency room in which there are about 12 different speakers. I don't identify them all. You just sort of figure it out. There's a collage of voices, emergency medical workers and young interns and a doctor, two doctors, commenting on this girl who's been brought in, who seems to have been raped. She's quite badly beaten. Her face is swollen and discolored and bleeding. And she's obviously traumatized.
You spoke a moment ago, and I loved how you described it, of a collage of voices, and that is what is so fascinating in reading the novel. There are so many voices, and often those voices can overlap, and they can also disagree with one another. And for you, that doesn't discredit that narrator. It just allows you to think about different aspects, right?
Yes, yes. Well, the Tawana Brawley case, of course, is rather infamous because as the grand jury finally decided, they ruled that it had there was no basis for her her accusations. Basically, she was not beaten. She was not raped. She was not malnourished. She was not imprisoned. You know, it was actually not a real case. So I wanted to write about that real case had it existed, you know, the case that didn't. The situation that was revealed to have been a hoax in real life happens many times. I mean, not that a girl is in prison for days, but a young girl in a difficult neighborhood is sexually at risk at any time. I mean, even very young children. And young girls and women are often, I would think, sexually intimidated and perhaps also often molested. They might be raped and never even report it. Certainly they would not want to report it to the police department. If the police department is anything like the police department in my novel, because they would get no sympathy.
Is it safe to say that the girl, the victim, Sybilla Fry, in your novel, is ultimately the sacrifice?
She's one of the sacrifices, but she doesn't just roll over and die. I mean, she has been quite physically traumatized. But she's got a strong personality, and she's somewhat sassy and rebellious, and that in a way that saves her. Instead of becoming mute and catatonic and very depressed, she lashes out in a way we would recognize as reckless, but she is a teenager. And some of her behavior is in relationship to her mother. Her mother is trying to control the situation, and the novel's based on there being a family secret that becomes public. It sort of erupts into a public scandal. But basically, if you think of it as a family secret, then the novel makes sense in a way. So I do explain the situation more or less, perhaps not overtly but obliquely by the end of the novel. You find out more or less what happened to the girl and who did it and why he probably didn't. In real life, of course, the Tawana Browley case is used as an example of a hoax, and there's no merit to it. But people were looking at it at the time as if it were real. And when you think about it, how many black girls and women are, you know, subjected to terrible treatment, if not by white policemen, by other men. You know, basically the Tawana Browley case, though it's revealed as a hoax, is also sort of shimmering with the possibility of real life.
For a time, the crime really does fly under the radar, and Sybilla is refusing to speak. And often there is, as you say, she's very sassy, but there is that point where you're worried as the reader that her voice will be lost in the story.
Yes, and ultimately it is. She's quite silenced at the end. She's sort of given up her personality and she's become somebody else. And I was also very interested in, when I started writing the novel, the original sacrifice is the young white policeman who's so unhappy because he hasn't been promoted and he's been let go from the police force. He's a rookie, and he didn't get promoted, and he's very unhappy. He commits suicide out of terrible depression, and then, of course, his name is taken in vain, and he's insulted. His memory is insulted by these people who are trying to launch a campaign with false accusations.
Obviously, one of the things you wanted to explore is truth, and I'm curious as to whether you got a satisfactory answer for yourself of why the truth is so often elusive.
Well, the truth is very elusive and complex, especially when you have a situation in which there is racism impinging upon people's lives. When you have a white racist society and exemplified by the behavior of the white policemen in these neighborhoods, it's a situation that white people, I mean like us, if you have a white skin, basically you move through it invisibly. You're not frightened walking down the street when you see a patrol car drive by we don't have the sort of visceral reaction that I'm led to believe young black men have quite often, and for good reason. So we sort of move through that world invisibly, and I think it's up to the novelist, or some novelists anyway, to sort of shine a light into these places and hold a mirror up to what is actually going on.
Joyce Carol Oates is our guest. She is the author of the new novel, The Sacrifice, published by Echo. When you talk about the job of the novelist, given how you look at a project, what is the timeline in the sense of when you start to think about something? Do you let it percolate for a while, or is it a fairly immediate thing for you?
No, it's not very immediate. I wanted to write this novel from the point of view of different voices. So the voices came one by one. And like one day I thought, well, a scene in an emergency room would be a great place so that we could see the girl from the outside, but from the point of view of a dozen medical workers, and sort of have short paragraphs, really short, some are only one sentence long, so that it's almost like a cinematic scene from all these different points of view. Then another chapter is a Hispanic woman detective who comes to interview the girl and what difficulty she has. But she does sort of pry out of the girl some information, but it probably is not the truth. It's a situation, you know, like torturing people at Guantanamo, where you are torturing people to get some truth out of them, but they don't know the answers that you want to give them, so they give some answer. I think that happens to many people and would happen to most of us in some circumstances. You're terribly pressured to say something and reveal something. You don't know the answer, or you have to keep a secret. In this case, the girl has to keep a secret. She can't tell who really raped her. She just can't do that because it's a family secret and would violate everything she believes in, and her mother won't allow her to do that. So she recklessly comes out and says, "White cop." And as soon as she does that, it's like she's tossed down a card on a table, and that precipitates the tragedy.
In writing that collage of voices that you spoke of a moment ago, how important is it for you to know the backstory of those voices, and also for us to have us, the reader, know immediately who is speaking and why? Because there is that mysterious element sometimes.
Well, it's not always that necessary. If you have a collage chapter in which there's a central subject, like this girl she's in the ER, and a number of people they're trying to treat her, and she doesn't want to be treated, and then her mother comes in. You don't really have to have a backstory for all these different people. You know, the emergency medical technician brings her in, and they have a discussion among themselves, but we don't know who they are because they're not going to be a figure in the story. But then the next chapter with a Hispanic woman detective, there's definitely a backstory, and that's definitely very clear. So we know who she is, and she comes back in the narrative. We follow her quite a bit until the end of her story.
And you enjoy that when those voices come to you, warning where they come from and who they are.
Well, I do a lot of reading, and I see movies, and I talk to people and hear people. You know, it's not that I'm in some reclusive state. So the voices that I hear in the world or may read about, those voices are transmogrified into the prose. So they're voices that are realistic, but they're not taken verbatim from anyone.
You are certainly known for being a prolific novelist. And does that allow you a pace in your writing that gives you a strength of getting it right the first time, in the sense of not working on it for 3, 4, 5 years?
Well, I work on it long enough so that it seems completely realized. I did have a novel called The Accursed that I wrote originally in 1984, and then kept looking at and revising a little bit, and then completely rewrote in 2011.
Right.
That was most unusual. So that happens once in a while to a writer, where you just can't get the voice, it doesn't, you know, have the ending, or something's wrong. And years and years and years go by, but I was working on other things, and so I went back to that. But with a novel like The Sacrifice, I would do research, and as I said, I had lived in Detroit in 1967, so for years and years I've been thinking, now I got to write about a black family. And I write about a black family whose lives are sort of exposed to the world because of this terrible, the media fascination with what happened. So the Tawanda Browder case is a good example of the intersection between a private family and then a public arena.
You do write about the media in this novel, and looking at that as a very large force of the story, and really how the family and the cops and all of those involved are playing to the media, aren't they?
Well, at a certain point, they sort of have to, I think. If you're an activist for social justice, let's say, you have to court the media. That became known, I guess, in the 1960s, because the media forms public opinion. Public opinion may elect different politicians. If the whole campaign for, say, civil rights, the campaign of Martin Luther King Jr., the nonviolent movement, which is so laudable and so courageous, that really depended upon a respectful media that would cover these marches in Selma and elsewhere, and, you know, pay respectful attention and detailed and considered attention to what Martin Luther King and his people were doing. So the media is a force for tremendous good. But then sometimes the media becomes sort of caught up in a sort of fever, you know, and the media is maybe inflaming a situation, perhaps.
I think one of the first times I interviewed you was actually in your office at Princeton, and it struck me as I got to watch one case of a relationship that you have with your students in their writing. And I'm curious as to, have you noticed differences or changes in discipline in the students and even in the culture and in the environment as writers?
Well, I think probably there has been a shift and that the consciousness is a little maybe less concentrated. But I don't see those students. The students we have in the writing programs are first, of course, intensely interested in writing. So they've been writing since 6 years old. You know, some of them have published short stories in student literary magazines and so forth. So I see such a small fraction of young people. Right now I'm teaching at Stanford University. I have 13 excellent students. They're very, very good readers. They're enormously astute critics, and they write very well. So I don't think they've changed, you know, taking them as representative. Hmm. These typical students who are in writing workshops have not changed much at all since 1980, probably since 1965. I mean, it's a certain kind of very, very driven, verbal, articulate young person.
And how much do you remember and recall and even mirror what you learned from your teachers as a young writer?
Well, I'm not sure that I learned a lot as a writer, because I was majoring in what's called American Studies, American Literature and American Studies at Syracuse University. I took many, many courses in literature. I did take writing courses also, but it wasn't an era as it is now in which the writing programs were so prominent. In other words, you'd take the literature courses and maybe take a writing course. But today, students may focus more on writing and MFA programs. There were very, very few when I was a student. I would not have taken an MFA program. I really wanted to have a lot of substance. I wanted to take courses with content. I didn't want to just, you know, be writing, because I would always be writing anyway, so I wanted to learn something.
There is such variety in your novels, and there's so many facets to it. Do you try to instill that in your students as well, to look for a variety?
Well, students are young, and they're working on what they have to say. They're working on material that has emotional resonance for them, and it takes them a while to deal with that. I would never come in and tell them they should be writing about something else or more variety, because they're doing one thing. It's like a young piano student is learning a Chopin nocturne. Mm. Just to do that, that's going to be months and months and months or years. To do that really well, you wouldn't come in and tell the student, well, why don't you do some jazz or some boogie woogie or something. I mean, it's basically people have to focus and concentrate on doing one good thing. Then when they're done with that, certainly they should branch out and do something else. But one project at a time is quite enough.
Was I right in my premise, though, that you do look for a variety, that you try to do something else each time?
In a sequential way. After one novel, I would write some short stories usually. I interspersed writing a long work with short works, for instance, book reviews and essays and memoir pieces. When I wrote The Sacrifice, I would take a break and write maybe a short story or something. Certainly book reviews. I write quite a bit for the New York Review of Books. And my reviews for the New York Review of Books are basically review essays. They're quite long, and they involve reading and rereading books and thinking about them kind of carefully. So that's a good break for me from writing fiction.
And it should be noted that even when I say that you look for a variety, you certainly, as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, you have written about race before. So there are those interests that you have, and certainly about young women, of looking at that and then saying, okay, I'm going to take this in a new light. And in this case, in mirroring a bit something that most of us are somewhat familiar with in the Tawana Brawley case.
Right. And then subsequently, the Ferguson, Missouri case erupted, and of course the Eric Garner case in New York City and others elsewhere. Tamir Rice, I think that's maybe in Chicago. So there are all these other episodes of racial, outrageous racial profiling and discriminatory behavior on the part of the white police. So my novel fits into that. So in such a timely way, but I had actually finished the novel in January 2013.
And how do you react to that then? When you have finished a work and you have come to some conclusion, fictionally speaking, and then you see the real life events unfold, how does that make you feel?
Well, it seems almost prophetic. If you read the novel with the ending of the novel.
Right.
I don't want to give away too much, but
no.
a kind of maddened, frustrated, and overwhelmed black man kills two white policemen, basically. And that something like that, just very much like that, happened in New York City just a couple months ago. So basically, it has this eerie, completely coincidental, prophetic quality to it.
And when you read a story like that, knowing that this novel is in the queue and ready to come out, do you think of it as that maybe it can add in some way to the conversation that we're having about these very difficult issues?
Well, I would hope so. I think that writers should bear witness to the complexities of their time and to social, particularly social injustice. The victims of social injustice often don't have access to writing or to speaking, presenting their own case. So it remains for people who do have the ability, people who have the economic freedom to present a case like this. There's virtually no one in my novel who would be able to tell his or her own story, really. They're, they're so downtrodden. They've been so poorly educated and so handicapped by poverty that it really remains for other people to shine some light upon the ongoing tragedy.
The name of the new novel is The Sacrifice. It is published by Echo. Joyce Carol Oates, what a great pleasure to have you back on the Book Show. Thank you so much for being with us as always.
Thank you.
It's a great pleasure. Again, the title of the new book is The Sacrifice. It is published by Echo. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.